you a high performer, obsessed with growth, and looking for an edge? Welcome to Mind Body Peak Performance. Together, we'll discover underground secrets to unlocking the full potential of your mind, body, and spirit. We'll learn from some of the world's leading minds, from ancient wisdom to cutting-edge tools and everything in between. This is your host, Nick Urban. Enjoy the episode. Hello, folks, and welcome back to the show. I've got an interview for you that I broke into two parts. To keep it short and concise, the first part is a little more technical than usual. We discuss things like vitamin C, antioxidants, what's called orthomolecular nutrition, and biological dentistry. And then in the second part, we talk about rapid virus recovery, some powerful tools that I used when I came down with a certain respiratory illness several months back, and then also what our guest this week has seen work and documented in his recent book. Our guest this week is Thomas Levy. He's a board-certified cardiologist and has written 7 books and counting on health-related issues. He's focused on how to restore and maintain good health, even in the face of the many different forms of toxicity that all of us face, typically on a daily basis. He no longer has a clinical practice in medicine and cardiology. Instead, he focuses on research and writing. Some of his books include Magnesium Reversing Disease, Hidden Epidemic, The Toxic Tooth, Death by Calcium, Primal Panacea, Stop America's Number One Killer, and Curing the Incurable. If you like this and want to learn more or to pick up his books, you can go to peakenergy.com. And the show notes to this one will be at mindbodypeak.com/69. If some of the biochemistry and how vitamin C works loses you, make sure to tune in to the last part where we discuss biological dentistry and why going to conventional dentists can just be giving you a false sense of security about the state of your health. And now we'll get started. Dr. Levy, welcome to the show.
My pleasure to be here, Nick.
Happy to have you today. We'll start off with the usual warm-up, and that is, what are the unusual or non-negotiable things you've done so far today for your health and performance?
Taking my vitamin C and my other supplements with a small dose of cortisol, because I've come to believe I'm a bit adrenally insufficient, and that has helped an enormous amount additional. We might talk about that later. And had a good lunch and looking forward to getting a little work done this afternoon.
Perfect. Well, let's start right there. That's a good place. With vitamin C, that's been one of the original supplements people were taking for the antioxidant effects. And people thought that it wasn't absorbed very well and the RDA was not what it should be. And you're a big proponent of vitamin C in higher doses. Can you tell me more about that?
Well, I'm a proponent of vitamin C being dosed appropriately. If you don't take vitamin C at all, you're way off base. And if you take a little vitamin C a day, that's better. But the human liver is designed to make its own vitamin C. But we're missing the fourth enzyme in a four-enzyme sequence that converts glucose, of all things, into vitamin C. And in animals that make their own vitamin C, which most of them do, with rare exceptions, animals that are roughly the size of an average human being will make and secrete directly into the blood. That's an important point, too. So it's not like you're supplementing a certain amount and you're getting 100% absorbed. So when you're making your own vitamin C and it's going directly into the blood, you're talking about 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 grams a day being made and secreted directly into the blood for baseline. And when you're faced with an acute stress, an acute infection, acute toxin challenge. It's designed to skyrocket and then start secreting into your blood 20, 30, 40, 50 grams until the toxic stress is resolved. Now, even when you're supplementing 5, 6, 7, 8 grams a day, you're really only getting maybe 1 or 2 grams into your body. So the point is even the high doses that some people say are being recommended by people like me are still not actually touching what your body needs, okay? And this is one of the primary reasons why the human population doesn't just live healthy until it dies. It lives reasonably healthy for the first half of the life and then spends the second half of the life suffering from numerous diseases, on a bunch of medicines, and just generally having the dwindles by the time they die. These things such as heart disease, cancer, these are all high oxidative stress type scenarios, which largely, not completely, largely would not occur at all if our livers were functioning normally and we were responding with the amount of vitamin C we need from one moment to the next by this synthesis that takes place. So yeah, vitamin C is important because, as it turns out, it's actually the primary fuel on which every cell in your body runs. Okay, so it's an antioxidant, meaning it has electrons that it can release and donate. And in so doing, it can repair biomolecules that have been oxidized. They've been oxidized by toxins, by prooxidants. They've lost their electrons and they become inactive. And the vitamin C can come along and recharge, donate the electrons, and then that biomolecule restores its normal function. And this is significant because, as simplistic as it sounds, all disease, 100% of disease, medical conditions, you name it, is in the affected cells in those disease states. You have increased intracellular oxidative stress, which means you have an increased number of different biomolecules that are in the oxidized, inactive state. And it's the inactivity, the neutralization, the neutering, if you will, of the biomolecule in its normal function, whether it's an enzyme or a fat or a sugar, that is the disease. You don't have anything else going on in your body that really causes a cell to be quote unquote diseased, other than the type, the concentration, the location, the duration in which a unique array of biomolecules have been oxidized. And you get the different arrays because different toxins have different biochemical structures. And what I'm talking about applies to all toxins. The toxin is not a toxin unless it causes abnormal oxidation. That's what makes a toxin toxic. When you have a toxin, it could be small molecule, large, it could be ionic, it could have a water solubility, fat solubility. It has a number of its own unique chemical properties, and that determines where the toxin goes, where it accumulates, and where are the biomolecules that it oxidizes. So that gives you your variety of illness. I mean, all toxins cause disease by oxidizing, but the biomolecules that they oxidize are uniquely determined by the chemical structure of that toxin and whether you inhaled it, ingested it, how your exposure was determines where it goes. So all of that comes down to the fact that, to put it all together, there's two aspects to ongoing disease and treatment. One is, what are you being exposed to on a daily basis? In other words, where are the new sources of oxidation? Where are the new toxins? And this is balanced by how much vitamin C and other quality nutrients, and a nutrient is only a quality nutrient to the extent that it metabolizes down to a molecule that has antioxidant character. So how diseased you are depends on how much new toxins are coming in and how effectively you're repairing the old damage. And if you're really taking a large amount, spilling over and neutralizing the new toxins as they come in. So there's a lot of things out there that will help you, but they only help you to the extent that they allow old oxidized biomolecules to be reduced and restored to normal function, and how well they limit, mitigate, or stop new toxic damage from being occurred. So what causes disease, and I like to say, is extremely simple, but remedying it is not so simple. Remedying it is much more involved, but as long as you keep these concepts in mind, you can have a good idea as to whether what you're doing or not is getting you from point A to point B.
Will you go back and summarize the free radical theory of aging and what oxidative stress and oxidative damage are for listeners?
Sure. Well, it starts by knowing the definitions of oxidation. Oxidation means a chemical reaction in which the molecule that's in the reaction is losing one or more electrons. When you've lost one or more electrons, the remaining molecule is considered to be oxidized. And when it loses those electrons, like I mentioned earlier, it also means that it can no longer function normally. It either doesn't function at all, or it might be an enzyme with a greatly decreased capacity or function. So the other thing is that the yin and yang of that is reduction. Reduction is when you donate electrons back to a molecule that has lost those electrons. And this is the complete repair. So when you can get this done, you can bring that damaged, if you want to use that term, biomolecule back to normal by the donation of a new electrons. The other thing that's important in understanding, as you said, the free radical theory of aging. Well, as I mentioned, all disease is excessive oxidation compared to reduction. And the longer that is and the more chronic that is the essence of what aging is. Now, there's a lot of stuff in the literature, and I think it's important to understand that, well, my own personal feeling is that a lot of literature is written by individuals and scientists in their various subspecialties, and they don't really want to be understood. They want to play their own little game and have their own little niche and be able to go to their conferences, and they don't really want to be well understood because that sort of lessens the intellectual impact of what they know if they think lesser people know it as well. That's the side point. So it's important to understand then that a toxin is the same as a prooxidant, is the same as a free radical, is the same as a reactive oxygen species, is the same thing as a poison. All of those are synonyms, they mean the same thing, and they all mean this is an entity that's trying to steal or rob electrons and oxidize molecules wherever they encounter them. And so the longer you have more new toxins coming in than you have new antioxidants in your body on a daily basis, the more rapidly you age. If you can hold the dogs off, as we say, if you can effectively knock out your high daily sources of new toxins and keep a very healthy, large nutrient antioxidant intake on a daily basis, you'll age, but you'll just age due to what's called physiological oxidation. In other words, there's no way you eliminate oxidation in your body. But once you get above the oxidation that's needed just to fuel the processes in the cell, then that's things where things start getting cumulative. But as long as you're not taking in new toxins and you're keeping your antioxidant intake a high quality and a high quantity, that's how you live to the end of your normal lifespan with little or no disease and symptoms until the organism is just ready to pack it in.
You mentioned something earlier that I want to highlight, and I didn't realize that you should be able to convert glucose into vitamin C, except we're missing an enzyme. Is it possible to supplement that enzyme and kickstart the process?
Well, it's a good thought. Right now, though, we don't have that ability, but we do have additional data now that shows us that the loss of this fourth enzyme in the sequence in the liver to make glucose into vitamin C is an epigenetic defect, not a genetic one. Genetic meaning you've just completely lost, or you have too abnormal a sequence of DNA to ever code for the enzyme that you need. In this case, even though there might be alterations, you have a sufficient quality of DNA to give yourself the piece of messenger RNA needed to be transcribed, but it appears, and there's a lot of data to support this, that in the translation process of the messenger RNA into the final protein, it's called galonolactone oxidase, GULO, that makes the vitamin C. In order to make that, you need to transcribe. You need the ribosome to ride down the entire messenger RNA strip to make the protein. Now, for whatever reason, and being epigenetic, it will probably have to do with toxins and nutrition and everything like that. Nearly everybody, after birth, because most babies can make vitamin C, but they lose the ability. So sometime after birth, they get what's called an abnormal stop codon in the middle of the messenger RNA strip. So the ribosome goes down, hits the stop codon, that's it. Makes a piece of a protein that doesn't do anything. We've now found, well, I guess through pure serendipity, pure accident, but I think that's the nature of most discovery anyways. Truth be known, it's just accidents. And the only intelligence comes in when you are aware of and realize the significance of an accident that's taken place. But they have nutrient polyphenols. And there might be more than one, but we found that the nutrient polyphenol in high concentration in olive leaf extract, it's called hydroxytyrosol. And a substantial dose of hydroxytyrosol has been shown in volunteers who aren't supplementing anything to, within a week, double their blood levels of vitamin C. So it would appear that, and there's some other data to support this, that somehow the hydroxytyrosol causes what's called a read-through or skip-over. Okay, so who knows exactly how, but it facilitates the ability of the ribosome to somehow ignore, skip, or go past that blocking stop codon and continue the translation of a complete intact protein. Pretty sexy stuff. So because of that, I often said that vitamin C, magnesium, vitamin D3, and vitamin K2, because of their impact on calcium, which promotes all diseases in excess, as my four basic supplements. And I say basic because a lot of people can't afford that much. All right. So, I mean, there's a lot of things you can take that are good, but most people are pretty much strapped. If you just want them to spend more than $25 or $30 extra a month, I mean, they don't have more than that. So when I say this, I just say that if you can afford supplements, those four should be in it. Well, I now add to that a quality olive leaf extract product as well, which are quite inexpensive to go along with that. Yes. I might add, too, that Dr. Ron Honeyhack and I of the Reardon Clinic, we were working with this about a year or two ago. And The concept is, and I told you that in animals that make their own vitamin C, is when you get a large toxin load in the blood, that metabolizes and uses up vitamin C. So if your liver is not making vitamin C, which in the case of most adult humans, it's not, you take in a large toxin load, and you continue to measure blood levels or urine levels, the vitamin C just precipitously drops as you use it all up. On the other hand, flip the coin. When you have a liver that can make vitamin C in response to an oxidative stress, the appearance of that, you see the blood level rise. And so Dr. Hodiaki and I, at his house, we gathered some people from the clinic so they could take blood specimens and make sure we didn't stumble all over the floor. We both took our toxins of choice. I took scotch, and he took a dark malt beer. And we both got reasonably blitzed. And then we made sure that they measured blood alcohol levels and vitamin C levels. And interestingly, at the first measurement, we didn't get as many as we would like to, but I mean, that's all finances too. That's why you need money to do stuff like this. We just wanted to have a proof of concept type of demonstration here. So the first blood test showed the alcohol level way up, and then initially the vitamin C level way down. And then the next one, the alcohol was still up and the vitamin C level had skyrocketed. And not only that, the vitamin C level stayed elevated for a full 24 hours until all the alcohol was metabolized and then came back down to normal. So do I have proof per se that the liver was making vitamin C? No, but I can't think of any other explanation. You don't have large vitamin C stores in your body that you could suddenly mobilize. And even if you did, they wouldn't be large in amount, and you wouldn't be able to mobilize them and keep it elevated for 24 hours. When you have an acute stress reaction, the adrenal gland actually stores some vitamin C as well. And you will initially see a little surge of vitamin C when you have a stress reaction before the cortisol. But that burns out quickly. So this was, in my opinion, clear evidence that this epigenetic defect could be overcome in many people much of the time.
What other antioxidants are you a fan of? Do you like the selective ones, such as molecular hydrogen?
You know, I have a hydrogen machine that I use from time to time. I liked all the literature I read on it. I can't say I have any significant clinical experience, so I can't say, yes, it's fantastic, or it's of no use, but I was impressed enough with the literature to have it around so that when I do have my own particular problems, a new infection, this, that, or the other, I have that to add to the regimen. So yeah, I like the concept of hydrogen. The literature that I've seen on hydrogen is excellent. And I think it represents a strong contributor to a good supplemental regimen. Unfortunately, you know, as I mentioned before, I believe right now it's one of your more expensive supplements. So it's not something that you're going to be able to help a lot of people with, but conceptually, and if you do have the money, I think it's a good thing to add to your regimen, sure.
Yeah, okay. So let's talk about the less expensive options then. How do you prefer to get additional vitamin C into your bloodstream?
Well, it's all a matter of degree. If you can afford it, the liposome encapsulated vitamin C, particularly the one made by Livon Labs. There's been so much fraud in liposomes. I don't have any confidence in any other liposome product other than Livon. I've worked with them for 15 years. I've seen phenomenal results with their liposome technology. It's a pricier form of vitamin C, but you get a lot more bang for your buck. It's my clinical opinion, I emphasize, that 1 gram of the Livon Labs liposome encapsulated vitamin C has the clinical impact of 6 or 7 or 8 grams of regular vitamin C that you would take. So, but still a lot of people would find it easier on their pocketbook and still offer a lot of help just to get sodium ascorbate powder. And, you know, take a half a teaspoon, a couple grams, 2 or 3 times a day. That's a good level to take. Again, with all the other factors we're talking about, expense and frequency, et cetera. Ascorbic acid is fine. Costs about the same as sodium ascorbate. But some people contest this, but I yet to see the data. I see no superior effect of ascorbic acid over sodium ascorbate. And although it doesn't upset everybody's stomach, it does upset some people's stomach. So I say, why even go there? Take something that you tolerate well, like sodium ascorbate. And there's a big thing out there on buffered vitamin C, buffer meaning calcium ascorbate. You don't want extra calcium in your system at all. I have a complete separate book on that called Death by Calcium. And the title is not an exaggeration. So you need to steer clear 100% of supplemental calcium. It will feed every pathological process in your body. And when you take it on a regular basis, it's a primary reason for the development of new cancer.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I read a book called Magnesium Miracle, and it was talking all about the balance between calcium and magnesium.
Right.
And I know so many products out there have more calcium than magnesium. And because magnesium is deficient in diet already, it's something that we shouldn't be adding alongside calcium. We should be taking that, and we already get plenty of calcium in our diets.
Right. Absolutely. No, it's, and 100% of intracellular pathology, which is really where all disease is. I mean, you can have an abnormal extracellular space, but it's the health of the cell, the redox status of the cytoplasm that determines health. And increased intracellular calcium always increases intracellular oxidative stress. You can't have one without the other. It both is a marker of increased oxidative stress in the cell, and it's a cause. Wow. And it's not until you get magnesium in that you can push the calcium up. You can't have high levels of calcium and magnesium in. They're opposing factors. So you get one to come down, in this case, the calcium, by pushing the magnesium up. And once you get the magnesium up, then you can start getting more vitamin C in your cell. You can start normalizing the oxidative stress in the cell then, so that the body's glutathione synthesizing enzymes are no longer oxidized. They get reduced. And then you can start making more glutathione. And that's what fuels the overall health of the cell, yes.
Yeah. What about preparations that have rose hips or other things that claim to increase the bioavailability of the vitamin C?
Well, if they say it improves the bioavailability, I would say that's completely wrong and flawed reason. However, one thing I've said for a long time now, in all of my talks and interviews and writings, any positive nutrient has antioxidant capacity. Any negative or toxic nutrient has pro-oxidant. Okay, we're getting back to the yin and yang of redox medicine. So bottom line is, the more you have of a wide array of high quality antioxidants that can also work with vitamin C to recharge it, donate electrons back to it, so it can then migrate somewhere else and give those electrons where they're needed, that's fine. And that is higher quality supplementation than vitamin C by itself. Is it necessary for vitamin C to have its impact in a given clinical situation, especially if you're dealing with an acute infection or something along those lines? No. And the thing is like I said, the more antioxidants, the better. With the public having limited money these days to spend on supplements, like we've been talking about, you don't want to make it unduly expensive for them to be able to take 4 or 5 or 6 grams of vitamin C a day. And if you take it as pure vitamin C, you know, it might be 50 cents a day. If you take it as part of this big complex, it might be a couple bucks a day. So again, fine to take other things, but just don't be misled into thinking that vitamin C is not vitamin C unless you take it with something else.
Dr. Levy, one more question on vitamin C before we go on to some of the other topics we're going to cover today. And that is, if you're an exercise enthusiast, you like to work out, what's your idea on timing of vitamin C and potentially blunting the hormetic effects of exercise that occur via oxidation and cell signaling?
I tell you what, I know a lot of people have been trying to make a ruckus about that. I don't think it matters. Okay, I'll be honest. When I was younger, I did a lot of weightlifting and took a lot of vitamin C. And sometimes I took it before, sometimes I took it after. But there was a period of time where my strength just skyrocketed like I couldn't believe. So what's important to always think about the physiology and the pathophysiology. I mean, you do generate oxidative stress. I've not seen any evidence that says if you take vitamin C after exercising, you're going to blunt the response that you were looking at that was going to help you be stronger, develop more muscle tone, develop more exercise capacity. If that concept is true, I have yet to see the data. So I'm not going to say it's impossible. I mean, lots of things I don't know on this planet, okay? But again, I'm always open to legitimate data. So, but the final word to your question is, I don't think it matters. I think it's important, if you're exercising, even more so, to be taking even larger doses of vitamin C on a regular basis, because you are using up more vitamin C because the stress, the oxidative stress of both aerobic and anaerobic exercise, aerobic running and then the weightlifting and all, those consume large amounts of vitamin C. And if you're not keeping up with that, in my opinion, you could, maybe not dramatically so, but unless the rest of your diet was extraordinarily excellent, you can start causing damage to yourself by getting very high on your exercise level without matching that with a good increase in your vitamin C.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you there. I've been guilty of that myself, of overdoing it on the exercise, underdoing it on the recovery and the fortification of the body. Let's go on now to oral health and biological dentistry. That's something that I heard you discuss years ago and you piqued my interest in it. So can you explain why this is such an important thing to consider when people are looking to optimize their overall health?
Sure. It's interesting because we just talked about exercise. And I had a lady I've done some interviews with in England, and she's promoted my concepts. And she said, can you write up a little something that says how important exercise is to prevent or deal with heart disease? And I said, no. I said, I can't do that. And the reason is, not without these individuals understanding what infections in their mouth do in causing heart disease. So my point that I wanted to make is, if the only point you make is exercise to prevent heart disease, especially if you're already a cardiac patient, you're setting up that patient for problems if you don't emphasize to them the primary number one thing you need to do is get your mouth properly evaluated, get all the infected teeth out, resolve the infected gums, infected tonsils, because coronary artery disease is a chronic pathogen colonization in the coronary arteries exclusively from pathogens from oral sources.
Exclusively?
Exclusively.
Wow.
So I'll tell you the data on that. They have in 2006, a Dr. Ott did coronary atherectomies. That's like a coronary Roto-Rooter. You do a coronary angiogram in somebody that has known blockages in their coronary artery, and you scrape them out. You scrape them out. Physical pretty crude, but you know, you scrape out the clot. And so he did this on 36 patients and then analyzed the clot for pathogen DNA. And he found over 50 different species of oral pathogens, viruses, fungus, bacteria, and he found it in 36 out of 36 patients. That's what I call pretty doggone close to 100%. And the thing is, and what happens is the pathogens colonizing in the coronary artery. What do pathogens do? They produce prooxidants. So the prooxidants consume all the vitamin C in the cell wall. And what happens is your oral pathogens result in a chronic focal scurvy in your coronary artery. When your vitamin C levels drop to just about zero in a given area, that is synonymous with acute inflammation. So when the C goes down, the inflammatory indices come up, and then the inflammation triggers the immune system. And the immune system comes in with its all its different immune cells. And the reason the immune system comes in is because it tries to deliver vitamin C there. The first cell that shows up in an acute immune response is the monocyte. The monocyte has 80-fold, 8,000% more vitamin C inside it than the surrounding blood. It's literally a package of vitamin C that the immune system is ushering to the site where vitamin C is most depleted. Now, that's a fact. It's my opinion that this is the primary role of the immune system, is to deliver vitamin C where it's depleted and to do its best to restore the antioxidant status where it's been screwed up and poisoned with toxins. And the problem is, too, is you never get rid of these, so you never get rid of the pathogens, you never get rid of the consumption of vitamin C, and that acute inflammatory response becomes chronic. And so the chronic inflammatory response brings in more cells, fibroblasts, et cetera, and then you start building plaque and all sort of other things. One other point about the vitamin C and the building of atherosclerotic plaque. The body is designed to compensate and prevent catastrophic events when something it needs is missing. Okay, that's the name. You always want to have fallback mechanisms no matter what you do. Well, vitamin C, as I'm sure you know, is essential for quality connective tissue and collagen, strength of fibers. When you're chronically depleted of vitamin C, the structure in the arterial wall becomes weak. You're incapable of making normal strength, collagen, vascular, connective tissue. So what does that mean? What that means is, survival-wise, you're setting yourself up for the wall of the artery to deteriorate to the point where it starts to expand and balloon and you have an aneurysm and you rupture and you die. So what's the body going to do to prevent you from dying of a ruptured artery if it doesn't have the vitamin C to make the connective tissue? What it does is it starts bringing in fibroblasts, making fibers, building up plaque. Well, what is plaque doing in addition to obstructing the arterial lumen? It's thickening the wall. So it's making the wall that much more difficult to balloon and rupture. And all of that resolves, completely reversible, when you stop the pathogens and you get the vitamin C and other quality nutrients in, atherosclerosis melts away just as quick as it appears.
Wow.
And this is why, we're talking about dental here, they have a test now called the 3D cone beam examination. It's been around for about 15, 20 years. Now it's coming into the fore. The thing is, regular dental x-rays aren't worth crap. I mean, they miss as much as they find. So you get just that panorex of your teeth, most people, it just gives you a little basic anatomy and nothing else. Well, the cone beam examination is highly, incredibly sophisticated and detailed, and shows up very readily all teeth that have abscesses. And that may sound like, well, oh, I'd know if I had an abscess tooth. No, you wouldn't. 95% of abscess teeth are completely 100% asymptomatic. You chew on them, you do everything on them, they feel fine, they feel great. And unless you look for them, you will not find them. Well, when one abscess tooth can give you a heart attack, that's kind of something you need to look for, right? And I like to use the example of, if you walk into your internist's office for the first time and he looks at you and says, oh, wow, we need to start you on insulin right away. Your blood sugar is 385. Well, he has no way of knowing what your blood sugar is unless he measures it. By the same token, would you walk in and say, oh, wow, you have a clinically asymptomatic, severely infected tooth destroying your health? No, he won't know that until he does the test. It's my opinion, even though it's a little expensive, I think probably in most areas of the country, about $300. The 3D cone beam examination should be just as routine as a biochem panel, glucose, CBC, and thyroid, okay? Because yes, it causes heart attacks. Yes, it drains in the lymphatics and is the primary cause of breast cancer, but it's also the primary cause and or accelerator of all disease processes. So if you have, I use the example of a young person who gets their football examination, you know, their physical. I would say for the 18, 19, 20-year-old, this should be part of his workup. And when it comes back normal, which you hope it would, then he's got that on file. And when he's finished with football and he's in his early 30s and he starts developing any medical problem, headaches, diabetes, blood sugar, then you repeat that test and you see whether something else has come up. And just very recently, this really came home because a good friend of mine, it was actually the person that first got me interested in the cone beam before I wrote my book, Hidden Epidemic. She got a cone beam examination, whatever it was, 8 or 9 years ago, and to get some root canals taken out, get some implants put in. And at that time, we saw this other grossly abscessed tooth that felt perfectly fine. I said, look, I'm afraid you're going to need to get another tooth taken out, all right? And so fast forward, she's done fine for the last 8 years, and then developed a lump in the breast. And I said, well, you know, we saw the infected tooth 8 years ago, but hey, 8 years have gone by. We need to repeat the test. Repeat the test, two more newly infected teeth.
Do they spread?
Well, I mean, the infected teeth drain into the breast. That causes the mass. So no, I mean, if you have two newly infected teeth, they got to come out. That's it. All right. But the point is, and we all kind of do this, I think, you know, if at some point in time a test is fine, we somehow just tuck it away and say, well, that test is fine. I had no problem with that. Well, it might not be fine 5 years later. I mean, as things develop, you need to retest and recheck. We get old, we deteriorate, our bodies fall apart, and then we die, okay? We don't usually go from perfect health to death, all right? There's a transition point. And we have all this evidence. I mean, people get osteoporosis. Well, the tooth is a bone too. Okay, so what makes you think you have horrible osteoporotic bones and perfectly finely healthy structured teeth? Well, you don't. And the point is what causes an asymptomatic infected tooth with an abscess? And let me tell you, this is very, very common. The incidence is talked about in the book. Very, very common. Well, your teeth wear down, they get weak, and then you chew on something, might not cause pain, but you cut a little fine crack, a little crack of the tooth. Eventually the crack reaches the interior of the pulp, bugs get in, and then you start an infection. All asymptomatic. Or you don't take care of your gums. So see, teeth get infected from two directions. They get infected from above, when you split the tooth open and you gain access into the pulp, or you get them retrograde. You get infected gums and they go down the side of the tooth and then set up shop at the apex of the tooth and then grow into the pulp. No other way that I know of for a tooth to get infected. So and anybody that's had an infected tooth has got to take it out. I mean, they need to become a born again, take care of my tooth, teeth type person. I mean, get the water pick, put in some hydrogen peroxide in there with the water, and do that on a regular basis and keep all the gum line completely healthy and pathogen free. And that's probably the best way you're going to keep healthy teeth for the rest of your life.
I want to talk more about prophylaxis and what you can do at home to prevent yourself from needing to get teeth removed. Before we do, I think it was you that I heard speaking about root canals and how those should not be acceptable and the issue they present biologically and otherwise.
Well, it's quite simple. What happens most of the time is you get a painful tooth. I mean, that's what drives people to the doctor, to the dentist, anywhere, is pain. Pain or fear. That's what causes you to see a healthcare practitioner, is pain or fear. So your tooth starts hurting, and it might have a non-infectious reason for hurting, but that doesn't matter to most of the dentists. If it hurts, they know how to make it stop hurting. They stop hurting by cutting off the top of the tooth and coring out the pulp inside, which is usually infected. But what they always do when they core out that pulp is, you're cutting all the nerves. Okay, so it's like I get a big boil on my arm. Rather than drain the boil or cut the boil off, let's just say I snip every nerve that goes to the boil so that it doesn't hurt anymore. I have the infection there, but it doesn't hurt. Well, I mean, we're talking about the inside of the tooth. It's nothing you can see. So as long as you can make the tooth stop hurting, hey, everybody's happy and hunky-dory. Not the case. So point being is, some 25 years ago, Dr. Hal Huggins, in concert with Dr. Boyd Haley of the University of Kentucky, Dr. Huggins really was the first person not to know about the importance of root canals and infected teeth, but really to get the word out. And so he got together with Dr. Haley. Dr. Haley devised a test with his colleagues to assay for toxins in extracted teeth. And so Huggins coordinated with dentists around the country, and over the course of the next couple of years, over 5,000 extracted root canal teeth were sent to Dr. Haley. 100% of those had incredibly potent toxins. And just so nobody says, oh, well, it was contaminated coming out of the mouth, blah, blah, blah. No. They also submitted a number of teeth that were just extracted for orthodontic reasons. In other words, your jaw is getting crowded, let's get rid of this normal tooth surgery. Those had no toxins at all. So 100% of root canals are infected, necrotic, meaning the pulp is dead. Okay. The only difference is, depending on the flora that's in your mouth, is you might have an incredibly toxic tooth or a lesser toxic tooth, but they're all toxic. You know, you might have a species of bacteria or Clostridium in there that's much more toxic than others. But that's the other point too, is in using this testing, Dr. Haley was also able to show that using the test that he developed, some of these toxins inside these teeth were many-fold more toxic than botulinum toxin, which is considered by medicine to be the most toxic substance on the planet. Why on earth people inject it in their bodies beyond me? I mean, that's taking vanity way too far. I mean, I'd rather just have a few wrinkles than die of a heart attack. But, you know, to each his own. And the other thing that makes root canal so damn nasty is delivery. You can't design a better way to deliver toxins and pathogens into the bloodstream and into the lymph than to put it inside a tooth that you chew on and put enormous pressures. I mean, you're pushing toxins and pathogens into your bloodstream more effectively than if you put them in a syringe. Why more effectively? More effectively because it's not only getting into the blood supply, it's also getting into the lymphatics. I told you. You see these thermograms light up like Christmas trees, and the ladies with the lumps, you see the big red lines going from the teeth right down to the lumps. So the other point that doesn't get emphasized a lot, and since more people are starting to realize this, I need to talk about this more because I don't want a lot of people thinking that, well, I got my root canals taken out, I got two abscess teeth identified, and those were taken out. My gums are healthy now. My sinuses are clear. I'm fine. Not yet. Unless you had your tonsils taken out when you were a kid, the tonsils were draining those infections for a long time. And again, we have evidence from the work back in the 1950s. This individual who was treating advanced metastatic cancer patients, and all of them had a mouthful of infected teeth. Okay, so the first part of his regimen was to make sure those teeth got properly extracted. Then he did everything else and got them on his program. He had a little auto vaccine therapy that he developed from their own system that seemed to work very well. But a substantial number of these people who still, I think 15, 20% would get heart attacks in the middle of it. And I don't know all of his reasons, but he had a few patients where he worked on their tonsils and some of their problems got better, and it occurred to him that the tonsils were infected. So he started doing tonsillectomies along with the tooth extractions, and the heart attacks disappeared. Not only did the heart attacks disappear, but in his words, in his book that he wrote, 100% of the tonsils that were taken out, and mind you, these were tonsils that appeared normal. They weren't like childhood tonsillitis, big and ugly and red and inflamed. They just looked normal, normal size. 100% of them were severely and highly infected with pus pockets throughout the tonsil when they came out. So the point being is the tonsils bring a lot of people down because just like the asymptomatic tooth, they don't hurt and they're chronically infected. Now, it appears that going through a series of ozone gas injections in the tonsils can clear this up for a lot of people, but certain parameters have to be followed, and you need to know how to do it right, and you need to know that if you're not successful, that ultimately, if you want the protection against developing a heart attack for quote-unquote no reason at all, the tonsils would have to eventually come out. But that can be a second-line option. Because let me tell you, a tonsillectomy as an adult is a horrible experience. I went through it. I wouldn't wish it on anybody.
Okay. So how do people go about finding a biological dentist first? And then after that, we'll talk about some of the things that you mentioned that people can do today to start improving their oral health.
Well, they can go to my website, peakenergy.com. Under the resources sections, they have some organizations of biological dentists, and that would be a good place to go. And the links usually go directly to the Find a Doctor, Find a Dentist page on the website so that you can go to the different states and the different cities and get an idea. But to anybody that wants that, I mean, if you want to optimize your long-term health, you have to get involved. So you just can't hand over your warm body to a doctor, to a dentist, You need to read on these things, understand what's going on. And for example, it's tragic when it happens, but it happens is some dentists or doctors, depending on the case, will join these organizations, but it doesn't mean they follow all the premises of the organizations. The next thing you know, they go, quote, unquote, see a biological dentist, and without being well-informed, telling them what they want, they end up with two root canals when they leave. Okay, so you have to be your own advocate. You have to be your own advocate. You have to be diligent about it. You have to, the things I'm talking about, the books that I've written and the articles that I've written, some of them are a little technical, but for the most part, the concepts are very straightforward, and don't just give away your brain and your own ability to understand stuff because, oh, well, it was written for a doctor. I can't understand that. That's garbage. They are very simple concepts. I mean, I think everything I've talked about today is simple and straightforward. Okay. I mean, it doesn't involve understanding calculus or rocket science or the theory of relativity or anything like that. It follows that infections cause oxidative stress. Oxidative stress causes disease. Eliminate the infections, neutralize the oxidation, and you're going to get better. So.
And then you mentioned a couple things I want to highlight, such as obviously brushing your teeth is important and then flossing, but you like the water pick more than flossing, and then also using hydrogen peroxide in your oral care routine.
I not only don't advocate flossing, I'm against it. Okay. And I tell dentists this when I talk to them. I say, for example, if you get your hands dirty, do you go get a dry brush and try to scrape the dirt off? Yeah, you need to use water and soap. But let me tell you, if you just use water, that would do it as well. I mean, put in something else that helps, you know, mobilize that, that makes it even better. The other thing, too, is I think very, very few people can floss every day and not continue to re-injure their gums. Okay? It's just sort of really simplistic in... I mean, if the water pick didn't exist, if water irrigation didn't exist, then absolutely. I mean, you want to get stuff out that's stuck between your teeth, that's promoting bacterial growth and deterioration of the gums and more pathogens, but that's not the case. I challenge anybody, it's a quick challenge, is floss and then water pick. You're going to still see stuff come out. Water pick and then floss, you're not going to see anything. Water pick is, I mean, on rare occasions, you might have a unique anatomy. I have two teeth where the things really get tight. I actually use a small piece of floss just for that spot, nothing else, because it's just a unique anatomical configuration of the way those two teeth are touching. But the water pick does it all. And the important thing, too, is keeping down the pathogen count. You know, people get really compulsive, and they should, I guess, about being precise in directions, but it doesn't have to be precise. I mean, you can swish your mouth with full strength 3% hydrogen peroxide, switch it around, gargle it, spit it out. It's fine. Not going to hurt anything, not going to damage your teeth or anything like that. And you put it in a water pick. I put it in a water pick and then add maybe an equal amount of hot water. It doesn't stay hot because it goes through the machine. It just comes out warm. And you should reach the point where the highest pressure on the water pick doesn't cause any bleeding at all. That's when you know. And that usually occurs even with really bad gum disease. With mild gum disease, most people can go to high on their water pick after a week and not cause bleeding. Just about everybody, though, everybody that's never done a water pick, and the first one on high speed, they're going to bleed like a stuck pig. They'll say, oh, my God, what did I do? Yeah. But that's also an indication of how unhealthy most people's gums are. Because when you do this for a couple weeks, you can't make them bleed anymore. All the infection and pathogens are gone. The gums have tightened up. And all you do is just get away all the small particles that are accumulating, and it works like a charm. And as we said before, the other thing too, when I talk about this.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode. Head over to Apple Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts and leave a rating. Every review helps me bring you thought-provoking guests. As always, you can find the show notes for this one at mindbodypeak.com/and then the number of the episode. There, you can also chat with other peak performers or connect with me directly. The information depicted in this podcast is for information purposes only. Please consult your primary healthcare professional before making any lifestyle changes.